From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We'll have open lines for you later this hour. Next hour, Shadow People researcher Heidi Hollis joins us for an in-depth look at why people are seeing these entities. Just what does it all mean? Here's some of the stories of the day. Al-Qaeda conspirator Zacharias Massari helped himself get one huge step closer toward getting the death penalty when he testified that not only did he know about the 9/11 2001 attacks ahead of time, but that he and shoe bomber Richard Reid were supposed to hijack a fifth airplane and fly it into the White House. Massari's testimony in his death penalty trial stunned the courtroom as he disclosed new details in the case, many of which were in stark contrast to the self-confessed al-Qaeda member's previous statements, in which he said the White House was to come later if the United States refused to release a radical Egyptian sheikh imprisoned on earlier terrorist convictions. That's what he says. I was supposed to pilot a plane into the White House, Massari responded when defense attorneys asked him if he knew he was supposed to be a pilot in the 9/11 attacks when he was arrested on August 16th of that year. I only knew about the two planes of the World Trade Center in addition to my own, he added. In Iraq, a homicide car bomber killed 40, wounded 30 at an Iraqi army recruiting office outside a military base, as top Iraqi politicians blamed the United States for a weekend raid that Shiites said killed 22 worshippers in a mosque. The U.S. military acknowledged the raid had been carried out in northeast Baghdad, but said no mosque was attacked. Iraqi officials angrily disputed the U.S. account and called off political talks until an investigation could be carried out. In Israel, just 5 days before national elections there, acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's Kadima party revealed that it would divide Jerusalem and allow a Palestinian state to be established in parts of Israel's eternal capital. If you keep looking at the book of Revelation, this looks pretty close. The revelation here follows months of denials by top Kadima officials that the party would advocate withdrawing from Jerusalem. In Florida, some men have been accused of dragging a donkey behind a pickup truck. The animal had a rope tied around its neck and the other end tied to the bumper of a car. They have been arrested. County officials said they found the donkey laying on the ground, gasping for air with several severed open wounds. Jeez. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website under Hot Stories, take a look at the city-sized iceberg, which is creating such a stir down there in Antarctica. The city-sized iceberg has broken off near an island of Antarctica right around there. The iceberg is about 8 miles wide, 15 miles long. It broke free. The discovery was announced on Friday. You can just see a picture of this on the coasttocoastam.com website. Onshore wind farms will provide about 5% of Britain's electricity by 2010, according to their British Wind Energy Association. In a new report, it says that turbines are being installed faster than predicted. The report comes a day before the government there unveils a new major review of its climate change policies. Also on the coasttocoastam.com website, a 9-week-old kitten in California is expected to win a place in the record books as the smallest cat in the world. Heed, that's the name of the cat. Heed, the cat, is only 3 inches tall and weighs just 1.2 pounds. They say that once Heed is full-sized in about 6 months, veterinarians believe he will become the new smallest cat in the world. How about that? It's a great little picture, by the way, of the little critter. You know, ever since I moved to Los Angeles in 2003, I've had the pleasure of working and knowing a number of well-known national radio hosts like Casey Kasem, Dr. Laura, Jim Rome, Blair Garner. But I've also gotten to know one by the name of Phil Henry, a very talented person, who on Tuesday will be in a new television show for NBC called Teachers.
It's a show about teachers. It's a comedic look at the life of struggling teachers in a school that's not doing well, like many schools are not doing well in this country. And this is a television program that hopefully reflects their struggles through a funny prism. And not only dealing with the students and dealing with their workload, dealing with their own personal dreams, dreams deferred, you know, dreams that might have been, you know, the relationships between the staff. And it's a workplace, but it's a very vital workplace. It's a place called school.
You know, I'm so excited about this program for a couple of reasons. One is because I think teachers themselves have a tremendous influence on kids. And I have had two teachers in my life who helped steer me in the direction that I've gone now. And without them, I'm not sure that ever would have happened. But the other reason I'm excited about it, of course, is my friend and colleague Phil Henry is starring in this program. So in a moment, those of you who do not know Phil, you get a chance to meet him. Those of you who know him, well, get ready for this, because Phil's going to tell us a little bit about his part and this television show. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. As you know, I'm in St. Louis for a couple more weeks. And, of course, in the Los Angeles studio right now is none other than Phil Henry, probably in the old Coast to Coast studio. Phil, how are you?
I'm good, George. Thanks for having me on your show. It's an honor, dude. I'm on 100 stations. You're on 500. So I ought to be getting, you know, pretty good bang for my buck here. You know, I've got a few things I want to sell. I got some T-shirts. Can I give up my home number? We have a strawberry stand out front. You know, the wife and kids are doing some things. So if you folks like some good fresh fruit, good strawberries, hand-picked, I go out and pick them with many of the field hands. We've got a truck out front. We're selling those, lettuce. And also my wife makes serapes and rugs. So please come and watch the kids dance. We'll put a little Indian headdress on them. You can throw them nickels.
If this is any indication of what this television show is going to be, I will even watch it. Hey, congratulations.
I don't think so, George. I have a feeling. Well, thank you, George. That's nice of you, man. And thank you for having me on the show. You're a quality. You're really a gentleman, and I appreciate that. The show is going to be on tomorrow night at 9:30. And I guess one thing to say about television shows, I think people, mostly critics, tend to want to see TV shows as little movies, and they're really more like little plays. They're these little teleplays that come into our home every night, and for 30 minutes, we have to make a point, make the characters very lovable so that people want them back, and sort of engage the audience very quickly with comedy and pathos and all of those things. And I like our chances with this show, because I think it's silly. It's in a place that we don't see much on TV anymore, classroom. And if we can just get that word out there a little bit more in common usage, which is teacher, we might begin to think more about those people, and then we might start to take them a little more seriously than we do.
Well, you know, I was saying, Phil, before the break, that I had two teachers in my life who have had such a tremendous influence on the direction of my life. You know, here I was, a 16-year-old kid, and two of them, you know, one was Mr. Strom, the other was a Chuck Brickle. And these guys, you know, one was a music instructor, the other was a science teacher. And I mean, they made going to school fun.
Yeah, and they probably taught subjects that you were interested in.
Yes.
Yeah, and I had a history teacher. I had two history teachers, Mr. Ehring and Mr. Cacaro. And those two guys, I just loved them. And I look forward to the class. And you know, I think that teachers, you know, I don't know, man. I can't think of a much more underappreciated gig. We pretty much speak with our wallets what we value in this world today. And it's entertainers. I mean, who are the highest paid people in our culture? They're people that entertain. If we've got that responsibility, we need to direct the attention back to them. And like I said, you know, 30 minutes a night, you're not going to be making lots of really cool points that a movie that's 3 hours long is going to allow you to make. But what you can do is just sort of bring people back to this world of teachers, let them see these individuals as human beings, struggling though they may be, let them get a couple of laughs, and like I said, hopefully just sort of keep that idea out there. So, Mr. Brickle, huh?
Yeah,
I had him too.
Just
yeah,
super. Tell me about your character, Dick Green.
No, Mr. Brickle is more interesting than Dick Green. In fact, my character it was named Dick Brickle, and then we realized there was your guy, so we changed it. Dick Green is 50. You know, he's about my age. He's an aging
curmudgeonly guy. He's a guy that has been
just like you.
Oh yeah, yeah. Except I'm a little more happy-go-lucky. Dick wears cardigan sweaters, and I just go ahead and wear the wife beaters, you know. And I've got tats, and he doesn't. So that's the basic problem. But I think that Dick is a guy who is cynical because of the 30 years he's put in at the school, and he's seen the bureaucracy, et cetera, et cetera. But he won't give up. He won't quit. He won't go on to the prep school. He subverts the system by barbecuing steaks behind the school. Talking Jeff, who is the lead character, played by Justin Bartha, and Calvin Babbitt, who is played by Dionne Richmond, talking them into all kinds of schemes that kind of further subvert this officialdom that has so hamstrung teachers over the years. And in the process, they reach out to the kids their way, and they do show that they care about the kids. And these are guys that could have, you know, moved on to some private prep school maybe, or they could have moved on to some other kind of aspect of education, but they stay in this school, and they suffer the outrageous fortune of the place just to kind of make everybody mad that runs the joint, makes, you know, and get through to the kids. And, you know, that's a dedicated, I mean, it's amazing to hear these kids say, I love to teach, you know. But that's exactly what these people like to do. They love to teach.
You know, and I've always believed, Phil, that we should do away with the way they pay teachers and pay teachers based on performance. You know, if they're good, pay them a fortune. If they're not any good, move them out.
Yeah, yeah. Jaime Escalante, who the film Stand and Deliver was based on, he was a math teacher out in East Los Angeles, who, you know, was an amazing teacher. He once said that the highest paid teachers, should be inverted. They should be kindergarten teachers, and first and second grade teachers, because that's when the kid is beginning to, that's when you're really forming a child, and where the education is so vital. By the time they become college students, why pay those guys all that much money? Because you're basically just, you're standing at a lectern giving notes. How tough can that be?
Yeah,
absolutely. So really, the lowest paid teachers should be college teachers, college professors. The highest paid should be our teachers that are, you know, caring for the kids in nursery school, kindergarten, first, second, third grade, and on up. I like that idea. I liked it a lot. In fact, that's why I went to apply for a first grade teacher job. They said, well, are you qualified? I said, no, but how tough can it be? I said, and by the way, I'd like 300 grand a year. So I don't know, man.
So they said, go on the radio.
They said, why don't you just stick with what you're doing, Mr. Henry, which is not much of anything, but we listen to it occasionally.
Well, look, you are a very hard-working guy. I mean, I see you when I come in. You're there all the time. Now you're working on this television show. How did this evolution happen? How did you get the audition, and then what transpired?
Well, you know, George, my radio show is a show where I've developed a bunch of characters that I play, and I play them as callers. So they sound like these people who call talk shows. And what happens is there's a minority of people in our audience that we call callers, and they believe them to be real. So really, I have callers interacting with these characters that I've created for the amusement of my larger audience. They think they're, you know, these callers think they're real people. So I think what happened was people in the television business in Los Angeles heard these characters that I created and called me in to audition for this part. And I went in dutifully, because when television tells you, come on, kid, why don't you audition? Well, I have a funeral to go to. It doesn't make any difference. Okay. So I went in there, and I was wearing a top hat and tails. And because I was coming from my job at the Haunted Mansion also, because you know how well radio pays. So I work in radio, then I go to the Haunted Mansion, and then I also work the Carnation Stand. And then I went over, and I auditioned for this, and they said, you know what? You get this character pretty well, and they gave me the job. So we did a pilot. And generally, pilots wind up in the ash can.
Right.
But this one was picked up by NBC, and they ordered 6 episodes, so then we just finished shooting those. So this entire thing has been going on for a year. From the time we did the pilot to the time we finished doing the 6 episodes, a solid year. And now tomorrow night, we'll go on the radio, or go on the TV, and see, you know, if America responds to our efforts.
And it's going to be right after the program Scrubs.
Yeah,
right?
Scrubs is a very beloved show. People love that show, and we're proud to be on following Scrubs. We hope that we can, you know, hold, I think the number is, the you know, like 80% of their audience. You know, there's all kinds of formulas that figure in, but we're very proud. And Matt Tarsis, our producer, was a part of the producing team on Scrubs. We hope the show carries the same kind of comic sensibility that Scrubs has, you know, maybe. Taking it turning it in a different direction, but We certainly hope that that's going to be an hour of television that people can go to on a night when most everybody else is doing, you know, reality or drama.
Sure. Are six shows enough, Phil? You know, it took, how many shows did it take, for example, for, you know, all kinds of TV shows to succeed?
Everybody talks about Seinfeld, you know, how it stunk for the first 2 years. Six shows are enough to tell the network whether they want to order a new season.
Okay.
I don't think it's enough to build an audience, but the network isn't looking for you to build an audience over six shows. The network wants to see what kind of an audience you're attracting. Is it in a demographic that they can sell, that they really have got advertisers just chomping at the bit for? And is the show in line with the cost? In other words, is the show, you know, on time, on budget? Is it's not, you know, not a big problem? There's no actors that are, you know, making the production go over. Okay, so it's in line, and it's also making a little bit of bread in a demographic that NBC wants, which is 18-49. Then they say, yeah, let's go another season, and now let's see how this develops through the fall. We'll develop the characters, develop the writing. You know, there isn't one thing that you do on a television show that 900 guys in, they call them suits, although most of them don't wear suits. They wear sort of a cardigan sweater tied around their neck, and a lot of them are female. And so there isn't one thing you do in a TV show that there's about 900 guys, all with VP titles, that come in, scratch their chins, hold onto their elbows as they're, you know, and look worried and concerned that you're doing Shakespeare. Wait a minute. Did you change a word? What did you just do? You had the character do. Look, what do you think this is? Midsummer Night's Dream? Man, I'm doing a half-hour TV show. How dare you? Anyway, they'll weigh in. And then when they sit down to have their notes, and this is what they call meeting, then they kick the actors out real fast. And it's like, you got to see this. They go, okay, people, the network's giving its notes now. Get out. Come on. So they chase you out into an alley where you can pick through a garbage can for some lunch. And I'm kidding about that. But basically, if the network sees a trend in the right direction, then yeah, they'll order it again. So what we're hoping is, and I've been told that within three episodes they know whether they're going to keep it or not.
Well, that's now, exciting.
Well, I know Kevin Reilly was quoted at a media buyers meeting last week as saying that we'd quote like to incubate this show like The Office. The Office took a long time to get some ratings, and The Office also wasn't really holding the number that My Name Is Earl was giving it. But they liked The Office because it was reaching out to that demo. We're hoping. And we know the network is behind us, that the show will pull just enough folks. Boom, we get to another season. That's a beautiful thing. Now, let's say we get to five seasons, okay? That's when I'm going to come in here and buy this entire building. I'm going to give you a whole new deal, George. I will triple your salary. I'll let you own your show outright. And I would just like to lease you occasionally.
All right, that's fine.
And then we're sitting beautiful, man. We get into syndication. You, me, all those chicks you go out with, I know you don't like to talk about it, but ladies and gentlemen, let's be reasonable. Mr. Norrie's a handsome man, but he's not that much of a handsome man. And yet every chick I see him with, she's an album cover right off of FHM. Woo-hoo!
No, Phil, we're not going to go an extra half hour.
Are we not going another half hour?
No, we're just going to let you do this as much as you try. I love it. But I am going to let you wrap up the remaining 2 minutes I have with a little Art Bell, because you are as close to the real Art Bell as he is.
Well, and I thank you very much, George Norrie, and good evening, coast to coast and across America, all the ships at sea and the city-sized iceberg afloat. To all the Emperor Penguins, all of those who communicate with me telepathically, good evening. And Ross Mitchell, thank you so much for that open. This is the Art Bell Show. And in a moment, we'll be talking to a man who has been able to make himself so diminutive he can go through the fiber optics of your phone, come out the other side, and kick your ass if you say something nasty to him. But first, this from Peeman Enterprise. Friends, as the world comes to an end and the nuclear holocaust is all but having occurred, and the road warrior is taking your wife and your daughter on the back of his motorcycle, what will you use for spare cash? May I remind you that new Peeman Enterprise's counterfeiting machine can counterfeit up to 65 different national currencies and make rocks look like gold bullion. Yes, it's the new Peeman Enterprise's money-making machine. You.
Phil Henry, you are one talented guy. Hey, good luck with the television show. It's on tomorrow night.
Thank you, George. Thanks, man.
What time?
Tomorrow night, Tuesday nights at 9:30 on NBC. Tuesday nights, 9:30 NBC. TiVo it. Whatever you like. We appreciate your patronage, folks, and we thank you so much, George, for giving us this opportunity to talk about the show. I really appreciate that.
You deserve it. Phil Henry, talented syndicated radio talk show host, and of course, soon to be doing this neat television show called Teachers.
Thank you very much, George Norrie. And now,
shut up, Art. It's George's show.
Oh, I forgot. I'm doing weekends. Yeah.
All right. Next up, open lines, numbers to follow. I'll be back. That's right. We're going to have open lines for you for the rest of this hour. Then Shadow People next hour with Heidi Hollis. I get a lot of emails every day. This one from James in St. Louis. I like this one. Listen to this. It says, George, my great aunt married an inventor who claimed to have invented a carburetor that would get 60 miles to a gallon on a Cadillac. His name was Andres. I won't give his last name. They lived in Alameda, California. He was well of money wise. He sold his patent to an oil firm, in California. It might have been Union Oil Company. Then my uncle Len, who was a carburetor ignition repairman, made a trip to California to see the invention and brought back a prototype, which the oil company didn't know about. The carburetor looked like a normal one, except that it had four jets instead of two. My uncle complained that he had to adjust it every week and that it was just too much trouble trying to get the right air-gas mixture, so he just simply gave up on it. So I can say, yes, there was or is a carburetor that gave 60 miles to a gallon then. My Aunt Marie and my Uncle Andres lived well in California. My mom said that he was always coming up with some wild idea. One of the first things he invented was the inkwell that wouldn't spill when it was tipped over. He died in 1965, and his wife died in 1969. Inventors. I still want to have a show on inventors one night and just have people call in who have invented weird things. That'll be an interesting hotline. I'll be back in a moment. We'll continue now with open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let's go to the phones west of the Rockies. Why don't you get us started? You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George?
Yes, it is.
Hello. Hi, this is Faith from Vista, California.
Sure. How are you?
Good, thank you. I love you, and just I'm calling just to tell a little story here, if it's okay.
Yeah.
It's really short. When I'm 26. This happened when I was about 16, and I lived not too far from here in an old historical adobe house with my half-sister and her two kids. And I lived in a little room separate kind of from the house that was built onto the house. And, you know, at the time I was really lonely and kind of in a weird state of mind with going through stuff. And I was positive but sort of in a negative frame of mind. And my intentions were not necessarily clear, and I just kind of called in anything to sort of just show me, hey, there is something else out there, just anything. I mean, I don't care what it is. And it literally happened where one night, of course, it's right around where you're going to bed, but you're not quite asleep. Something was on me on my bed, and I couldn't scream, and it was the most horrifying experience I ever experienced. And I went to call out for my sister, who was upstairs, but I couldn't. And it was the most, like, just that feeling of fear that just overtakes you. But then I just slowed down, took a deep breath, and I focused, like, I just tried to feel this feeling of love and just send out this feeling of love. And it seemed to work. And it, like, I could breathe, and it felt like this, whatever it was, got off of me. And I could get up, and I got out of the bed, and then I thought, oh, my God, I got to run and tell my sister what happened. And there was no door. I had, like, these hippie beads in between my...
Oh, yeah, you just kind of fling them open.
Yeah, and I couldn't even get out of it. It was like something was swirling like a vortex around my legs, and it literally... Sorry, I'm a little nervous there. Slow down. It like, knocked me from behind my knees, and it pulled me down, like, from my hair to the ground. And I blinked, and then I was on another side of the room, and I don't know. It felt like a time lapse had happened. And all I know, George, is that I got up, I walked to the bed, and I just laid down, and I felt like, you know what, just go to bed. And the only dream I had that night was It was like black and white where I was floating away. Like I was floating in the middle of the air away from a door of light.
I got to tell you, your story, Faith, is going to be perfect for our guest next hour, Heidi Hollis, because that's what she's an expert in. Possessions, shadow people, whatever it was out to get you. And sometimes it feels like you're having a heart attack, doesn't it? Right in the middle of the night. Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Good evening. Carlos from Carson, California.
Hello, Carlos.
Hi, George. You know, looking at these demonstrations by illegal aliens, I just makes me ponder about how divided a country we become. You got the old against the young. You got the homosexuals against the heterosexuals. You got parents against children. You got illegals against the non-illegals. And it makes me also ponder about that fateful meeting back in 1773 when the leading financial families of the world, the Illuminati, decided to get together and formulate a plan to take over the world. And one of their plans, of course, was to divide the world, to divide countries, people against people. And that's essentially what you're looking at here with the illegal immigration. The Illuminati has created the conditions to make illegal immigration rampant. They've sent the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, to Latin countries, African countries. They bankrupted these countries. And, of course, what you see is a consequence of that is the tremendous influx of people who are fleeing these countries because of the bankruptcies and coming here as illegal aliens.
Oh, they're desperate to get out of their own countries. I know. I understand that. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword, Carlos, because on one hand, as humanitarians, you've got to feel sorry for these people. I mean, because they are trying to get out of the horrible situation that they're in. On the other hand, we as a nation have to do something to protect our borders because it's out of control. And it's a horrible situation for everybody.
Well, I agree with you. But the worst thing we can do is pit people against people because that's what the Illuminati wants. What we got to do is inform the public what the grassroots, the real cancer is, which is the institutions that the Illuminati is using to bankrupt all these countries, because that's what's essentially triggering illegal immigration.
Well, but it's not just the Illuminati, Carlos, because if these major corporations, which were in some of these other countries, these same countries that these people are fleeing and escaping from, if they would pay them a decent wage, maybe not as much as American workers get, but at least something that's competitive so it wouldn't be hurting our country as much, at least those people would then be able to have a standard of living and they'd stay there. I mean, one of the reasons why, as you well know, that they are leaving their countries is because they can make more money here, even for doing similar jobs. And, you know, I think one of the biggest criminals doing this is the corporations, because quite frankly, if they were paying decent wages in those countries that these immigrants are leaving, they wouldn't want to leave. They'd stay. And you know what? As long as that continues, we're going to have this problem. Thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good.
This is John from Springfield, Illinois.
Sure, John.
Talking about extreme weather on March 12th, we had two F2 tornadoes come through about 8 o'clock at night.
I know. You're pretty close to St. Louis. You're about 100 miles away. I mean, this is weird weather we've been
having. Well, it came within 6 blocks of my house.
Oh, I had one that came probably 2 or 3 houses away.
Really?
Yeah.
It did $100 million in damage. You can go to SJR.com and see pictures of it. And Bush still hasn't declared it a national disaster area around here. And then a week later, we had a blizzard.
Oh, my God.
And talking about the guy about illegal aliens... I had a weird idea. It probably sounds far-fetched, but you know those quarantine camps they're building for the avian flu that you were talking about?
Mm-hmm.
If the Congress passes the bill, overnight it's going to make all of those people, 12 million people, felons. Where are they going to put them in prisons? You know, where are they going to put them at?
Well, you know what? That's a good point, but I have a feeling they're not going to arrest them, and I don't know how they're going to get them back to their own homeland.
You know, something else, George, out of 12 million illegal aliens, if you you go by the math, what are the probabilities? How many does it take to be terrorists to come into this country? Out of 12 million people, it would only take 1,000, if that. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I am amazed, to tell you the truth, that things haven't happened yet in this country since 2001. I cannot believe that our fine law enforcement has been able to stop every episode. I don't think they've occurred yet. And that's what bothers me. You're absolutely right. If you got 10 million, 12 million illegal immigrants, it doesn't matter anymore. You're just dealing with numbers. Surely there's got to be 100 or 200 or 300 of them who are out to do no good to the United States. I just hope we know who they are. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George. How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to tell you that I met John Teeter.
Wait a minute. You met John Teeter?
It was in a dream. And please don't discount it because it was a dream.
No, I won't. I'll let you tell us what happened.
Okay. Well, a long time ago, to make a long story short, I asked Jesus Christ and the Buddha and Krishna and Muhammad to put me in touch with highly evolved spiritual extraterrestrial beings.
And you summoned all of them up.
And listen, and they put me in touch with highly evolved extraterrestrial beings. So when I heard the story about John Teeter on your radio program, I did the same thing, only I asked, I summed them all up. And I also asked the extraterrestrial beings as well. And the morning of one of your very last big John Teeter's radio programs, I believe he did this on purpose. He came to me in that dream before a huge John Teeter broadcast on your radio program. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still listening. I'm in awe.
Okay, good, good. And he didn't say anything to me. It's funny because I saw him in the exact same place I'm sitting now, which is in my couch. On my couch in my living room with a TV in front of me, and he looked like he was a 6 foot tall individual, but he had somehow shrunk himself down to be about 3 feet tall for some reason. And he was wearing one of those army surplus blue pea coats, and he was wearing one of those dark blue army surplus sock hats on his head. And he was a Caucasian guy, but he was like almost like a dark-skinned Italian type of guy.
What did he want? Did he tell you?
Well, you know, I think I have a very important role in the second coming of Christ.
You do?
Yeah, I really
Why?
Do. I've been
Why
told,
you?
Why me? Well, I knew you were going to say that. I found out that I'm Gandhi reincarnated. I found out that before that I was George Washington reincarnated.
Now, how did you find all these things out?
I have been
past regression.
Pardon me?
Little hypnosis or what?
No, actually, it's kind of a long story. I'd love to talk to you at length sometime. I've been trying to email you. I mean, in all honesty, I'm going to be blunt, and I'm going to tell you that I and my grandma are the representations for the second coming of the Christ consciousness before I attain oneness with Jesus Christ, oneness with God, oneness with the universe. I still have human consciousness at this point. It's a very spiritually purified degree of it, but I still have human consciousness. And about 1997, Jesus Christ made an agreement with me, said, I'll help you come to me and self-realize to oneness with me at a very accelerated rate, but I would like you to renounce something for me that you like. And I said, what would you like me to do? And his hand on my picture of Jesus Christ on my wall raised to his mouth, and smoke came up from the picture. And I'd smoked cigarettes for about 10 years. Well, not at that point. I only smoked for about 3 years. And so I said, you want me to renounce smoking cigarettes? And basically, because it kills about 500,000 people every year, and it was something that is very hard for people to give up. And so
Wait a minute. Because you renounced smoking cigarettes, you will now become part of the second coming?
He wanted me to renounce something first. It's probably a message that he's trying to tell us all. And it took me, to make a long story short, he wanted me to do that in 1997 and get 1 year of time under my belt, having quit. And I'll tell you, I just accomplished it about 6 months ago.
You've been George Washington. Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah.
You're going to be Jesus Christ.
I'm not going to be Jesus Christ. This is the big confusion here. I'm another incarnation. I'm going to be another incarnation of the Christ consciousness.
Now, when does the world know about this, or are you already starting this mission?
This is probably the very first time I've ever told anybody. I've been trying to talk to you guys for 14 years, but it hasn't been allowed for some reason. I've been trying to tell people over the radio for
why now?
I think because I'm starting to personally be able to allow it spiritually. I don't think it was allowed. I didn't know and for sure up until about 5, 6, 7 years ago of who I am. I've been told all my life before I was born. I remember getting back from my last incarnation and just saying to myself, oh my gosh, I can't believe I didn't remember this that time. I remember coming into this incarnation from the other side, heaven and the astral world or celestial heaven, saying a mantra. This time I'm going to remember. This time.
Now, you do know how many people might think you're off your rock.
Oh, yeah. And he's told me that I'm... Now I know why the second coming of Christ is going to be rejected, because everybody thinks it's going to be Jesus Christ, and it's going to be a regular human being that he anoints. And he's
all right. Well, let me tell you, you check back with me when you're ready, seeing that it's been 14 years and you finally made it. Maybe it was all fate. I hit the right line. But keep in touch with us. Wildcard line, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yeah.
My name is Violet. I'm in South Dakota.
Hi, Violet.
My father died last week.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Sudden, or did you expect it?
Well, he was 88.
Yeah.
And I was going to the funeral, which is like 900 miles away. And my friend was with me in the car, and we're driving down the road. And I could almost hear my dad singing the cowboy songs that he used to sing to me on that road.
Like Happy Trails and things like that?
Yeah. And I was sitting there, and I'm like, oh, God, my friend's going to think I'm nuts. So I started telling her about him singing those songs to me. And then I just started singing along with him. And I felt his arms around me hug me. It really happened. I mean, it was like Tuesday night last week. And I was just, oh, my God. I felt my dad's arms around me. And I smelt the soap that he always used, you know. And I know he was in the car with me for a moment.
Did he have a chance to say goodbye to you before he died?
Not really.
Maybe that's why I think he came back like this.
We were always close. But
how did you feel? How did you feel, Violet, knowing that he had come back like that? Did it make you feel a little better about what had happened to him?
Yeah, I was a lot calmer about going to the funeral. You know, because it's not that I don't particularly like dead people.
Nobody likes going to funerals. No, I've met one guy in my life, one guy who enjoys going to funerals. Other than that, I don't know anybody who likes going to them, so I don't blame you.
Yeah, I think I'm normal, you know.
Well, now, would you like him to visit you again? That's the question. Or do you just want him to move on?
Well, I don't know yet.
How come you're hesitant?
Well, yeah.
Was it scary?
It wasn't scary, but it was... I don't want everyone to think I'm the weirdo that ghost visit, you know?
No. Happens to a lot of people, Violet. As a matter of fact, we'll find out when we talk with Heidi Hollis in just a moment just how many people it happens to. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in just a moment as Coast to Coast continues.